Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team.
I'm Chet Haas from the Toolkit team.
And I'm Brian Carlstrom from the Android Platform team.
Repeat
Brian.
Guest.
Yes.
Welcome
Brian,
back.
Brian was here a couple of years ago, I think, with Anwar talking about GC and VM performance stuff.
Yep, and I think Java 8 work as well.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay. So Brian manages a large team that is basically all of that. Right? Runtime.
Yes, what it is the underpinnings for Java, for C++, do other things too.
Yeah, core library stuff.
Yep.
Right? Okay. So like the ICU, like, yeah, okay. As well as, yeah, all the GC and art stuff.
Yeah, but also software updates and auth and like some of the autofill with Google work and things like that as well. But
basically everything. So Brian,
what do you do the rest of the time?
All the plumbing. You guys do the interesting stuff on top that people actually see.
Just the pixels. We just decorate the surface layer. Cool. So today we were going to talk about reflection.
Yes,
we're going to reflect on.
Or what is the term that we are associating with this?
Well, because it's not just reflection. I guess the larger thing is like we are trying to bring to P to the SDK what we did for Android N and the NDK, which is trying to keep people to focus on the public interfaces as Android has defined them and not be doing reflection and things like that on non-public interfaces.
Why is that bad?
So the biggest reason we wanted to do this is just part of our app compatibility efforts that that every release we do a big effort both of testing and manual testing of apps. Across a variety of spectrums, but also we in our own internal dog fooding, we obviously have a kind of longer tail of apps that we see. And we try to fix all the issues we can where we've introduced them and they're kind of self-inflicted where the platform team has made some change and, oh, there was something we didn't think about. And so we try to address all those obviously before we launch. The developer preview process is part of helping get it out there so we can hear from people when things we may have missed in the long tail. But a lot of things we see that we can't fix because they aren't self-inflicted or because app developers are using private interfaces, whether they be Java or native. And so we're trying to guide people forward gently to being focused on only the NDK and SDK interfaces. So the big change for P is like starting to try to lock down people to using only the SDK. And I shouldn't say lock down. We're trying to be a little more gentle than that.
So what exactly what is the user experience if you use an app that has been using reflection on unsupported APIs?
So it's going to be changing as we go through the developer preview and beta process, but the current developer preview, maybe I should talk about the different categories how we look at things because that kind of affects the user experience. So we kind of have four buckets for the SDK, which is a little bit more complicated than what we did for the NDK, where we only had three. But the four buckets are the whitelist, which is the SDK, so that's obviously completely allowed, and we want to encourage people to do that. We have what we call the blacklist, which are things that, as far as we know, no one is currently using via reflection or JNI or directly linking against something that's not public on the SDK. And those ones we're trying to like make sure that people who aren't using them don't start using them. And so that's where I think one of the areas we want feedback from developers in case we miss something. I could talk about what we're doing to try to avoid missing things. But then we're kind of in the middle. There's these two buckets of light and dark gray. And the light gray are basically the things that we know that people are using. The app developers are using, we can see it. We can see it in our logs. We can see it in our static analysis, looking at like Play Store APKs and things like that. And so we're kind of pre-populating that with a, yes, we know people are using these. We're going to warn you about it. You're going to start to see it in Logcat. And that's already there in developer preview. And you'll see now logs when you're doing reflection or JNI or linking to a class that is not part of the SDK, you'll see a warning. But it won't, it doesn't affect the user experience.
So just like a toast on top of the app?
No, not even. This is the first things we know people are widely using. So we don't only want the toast because we know about it. We don't need anyone to report to us.
Oh, I see.
So the next category is what we call the dark gray list, which are things where we put up a toast saying, hey, you, this is not something we know about. This is probably not something you should be using. As we go forward through the developer preview to beta to release process, that will be for APIs where we know there are public alternatives for these APIs, so once you target P, you're going to be losing access to the things that you're currently using via reflection or whatever. And so we want to have that toast because we're saying to you, hey, like this is something that's going to break. It's going to disappear on you when you target P. And so for the developer preview, if you see one of these toasts, like it has the URL to go report a bug or whatever, We really want to hear from people to make sure that we're, that's a known use that clearly you guys were already using it. Our NAP was already using it. And we'd like to hear back from you so we can move it to the light gray list where it'll just kind of warn you, but it won't be in your face. And it, and I think the biggest next step in the developer going from developer preview to a beta is everything that's currently on that dark gray list. We want to move to the blacklist. We really think those are things people aren't using. So it's really important to hear from people that, hey, I got this toast. I'm already using this. So please like move it to the light gray list and stop toasting, because we're going to move that to be the enforcing list for beta and then have that roll forward through to release.
This is all in the P release. Like you intend those things to be on the blacklist. For
the P. And so that's why it's pretty critical.
When you ship,
it'll
be three buckets basically.
So there'll still be this dark gray list for things where we know, hey, you're using this. Once you target P, we know there's a public alternative, and that's kind of a very enumerated list that we'll kind of have in the P behavioral changes doc, where it's like, if you're using X, please now use Y. If that's a problem and there's something missing or gap analysis, please reach out to us to know. But currently what's in, this is why it's confusing for going from developer preview to beta. Developer preview, kind of to get the feedback without breaking apps right outright for the developer preview, we just sort of had to do it, have it doing the toast when people access things. But those are the things we're proposing to be, no, you shouldn't be using these at all. And then there'll be some small amount of dark gray list left for the ones where we do feel there's a public alternative. But that list is pretty short right now.
What happens if there's some API people are using via Reflection, there is no replacement because we don't want there to be replacement? Like they're doing dodgy things.
So
what's the plan there?
So I think we're trying to be gentle for P. The goal for P is that no app should break.
Okay.
That unless there's a public alternative, and that's only when they target P. So any existing apps that don't get updated, we want to make sure everything that's currently being abused for better or worse will be on the light gray list for P. Okay. So that's a pretty strong commitment. We don't want to intentionally break apps, but if we are missing something, because sometimes our static analysis and sometimes our dog fooding and our manual testing, it just misses some apps. I know for Android N, we did a similar effort where we tried to lock down people's linking against native libraries that weren't part of the NDK. And the blacklist there was like all the system lib, that there's hundreds of things in system lib that no one ever touches. And we wanted to make sure no one started touching them. And then there was this kind of little list in the middle of a dozen or so things where people were using them. And we kind of like, look, once you target N, you can't use these anymore. And there was a couple apps were like, wait. Like after we released, they were, we had told you before. And it's like, well, sorry, now it's shipped. So we really want to hear back during this time frame to hear if there's anything people are using for better or worse, and we're not going to judge this year, and to move them on to
And this is something that users would report. So if I have some app I like and I'm running it on P and I discover some toast, I should take it into my own hands, because it might be the developer might not have a P device yet.
Right. And we really hope, I mean, this is a developer's blog. I hope the developers out there are trying to get access to developer preview and trying it out themselves to see for themselves what it's like. I don't mind getting the bug reports from users. We frequently do, both internally and externally on the issue tracker, get reports from users, and that's fine too. But I hope the developers are doing it, because I think even if you use the emulator and the SDK with the P preview, you should see the same warning. So it should be easy for, not easy, but like you have to, you shouldn't need a special device running the developer preview. Should you be able to detect these things in the emulator?
And this is enforced at runtime, correct? Like you've instrumented Reflection?
Yes.
So, because I imagine lots of users are going to be using the new alternative API when available, but they probably have a fallback path for Reflection. And that should still work, because you're only going to complain if they execute it on the newer platform, which they shouldn't.
Yeah, so it's dynamic. It's dynamic enforcement. So, so it only is if they're actually touching it. So we're not trying to like say, like, hey, we see some class over here that you never touch, and it references some classes that don't exist or we don't want you to know about.
No, that makes sense, because my next question was going to be, you could do a lot of this by scanning apps in the Play Store, right? But I guess then you don't know if it's actually being executed, if it's conditional, right? It's much trickier to know if this is a fallback path that you shouldn't complain about.
Good question, Tor.
All right. And we're going to leave it at that.
So I think that's one of the things we've gotten feedback to. Should we go and do this in Play Store and Developer Console? And like I've had to warn people, no, the false positive rate is very high because of exactly this issue. So when we've done our own static analysis to pre-populate this list, that was one of the problems, as we saw, is like that didn't actually correlate with what people were necessarily doing anymore. So we also did a bunch of manual testing on a couple thousand apps to just see what they're actually using and then correlate it with what we were seeing from the static analysis.
So this, you partially answered the question that I was trying to get to, which is, where'd you come up with the lists? I mean, both the blacklist as well as the dark gray list. And then the follow-up question is, how did you figure out which ones should be on the dark gray list, because there is an alternative that people should be using instead? Like, this sounds like a lot of tedious manual labor.
Well, fortunately, First, how do we start with the automatic analysis? As part of the art team, we have our, on-device optimizer, compiler, or whatever called Dextode that we call it internally. And we always run versions of that as part of our release and testing process across like the whole Play Store corpus of apps. So we already have like a pipeline. So like, hey, let's take our compiler, run it, see what crashes on the, and that's bad for us. So we go fix the bugs. And so we can do that. So we already have this mechanism for us to sort of do this sort of analysis. Historically was like, is our compiler crashing or not? And we also looked at memory stats and things like that, doing the Play Store analysis. But now we kind of adapted that and said like, hey, let's put some static analysis into that tool that we can do optional runs where we say like, hey, we see methods, or we don't do inlining and say like, we see methods that are looking like they're calling reflection things, and they're also doing, they're referencing class names that seem like they're verboten. And we sort of got a list and some analysis to pre-populate like that. So that was semi-automatic tool, and we kind of have some correlation then knowing which apps were the ones that led to certain things to be on the list. So then we follow that up with our app compatibility testing team and developer relations led by Sandy Gong. Like her team, basically we test like top apps like on an ongoing basis for OOP, whatever. And so because it does emit these logs in the log cat, we basically had them, when they did their like pass over a couple of weeks of testing the top apps, collect the logs for us that we could then also add those things that we were missing to the log. Because there were definitely gaps in the static analysis where people had convoluted helper functions to do reflection that were in our inliner, didn't quite inline it. So we couldn't tell that like, oh, this thing is calling this thing, it's calling this thing that's doing the reflection, and the class name was in a very distant place in another class. So we did have some gaps we found, but like through that analysis, we kind of populated further. In our own internal dog fooding before developer preview, we had the warnings and things showing. And so we got a lot more feedback in the long tail. So I think we're starting to converge down now to what we feel is the converged set of what we want. But obviously from developer preview, we're getting some more feedback of things we missed. And we're just hoping. And I think we did the same process for Android N with the NDK lock kind of restrictions. And so we're hoping that we'll have a good convergence that by the end what we should know.
Okay. So then step two was then how do you put it on the dark list because you know that there's something that they should be doing instead?
Well, I'm sad to say that we don't have very many things on that list. Not because we haven't looked, but because there really aren't public alternatives. People, generally speaking, aren't going out of their way to use reflection when there are public alternatives for what they're trying to do. I think one exception to that rule is sometimes there are clever app frameworks that are, I don't want to name anyone specifically, but they're popular frameworks on GitHub that we know about and see, and they are doing things because they want to be clever about how they do app architecture, and they're using reflection to sort of hook their framework into our framework in ways that weren't really intended. And those are tougher because like we're going to have a much more fundamental conversation going forward in the, is it okay to say Q is a release that might come after P?
I don't want to say anything about future.
We haven't committed to using the alphabet, have we?
Okay. I can't make forward. But anyway, so my point is like, I think we're going to we hope to try to do some of that work in P to go back to the various teams that own the APIs that are being reflected on and say like, hey, let's come up with a plan. But I think just because of schedule timelines and everyone's always optimistic about time.
Yeah.
That not enough of that happened in P to help us build the alternatives that we wanted for. And so we're going to focus on that in the future.
Like that, I think that's actually a good outcome of this exercise in general. Like the best outcome is better app compatibility. But if there's a really valid reason for these apps and frameworks to be calling these methods, then that argues for us to figure out a way for them to do it in a more correct way. Like the reason that we don't make every method in the world public is because it really backs us into a corner. So we only make public the things that, yes, this is the proper way to do it, and everything else stays private until there's a valid reason for it to become public. And this should then be part of that discussion.
Right. I think now, the last time I looked at the light gray list, which is, I think, hopefully public in AOSP, but if not, it's not something we're trying to be secretive about. There's about 3,000 methods and fields on it, which sounds like a lot, but I think if you actually look at all of the methods and fields in the system, it's like maybe 200,000, maybe
a lot.
It's order of magnitude. So it's actually not that much, I think, relatively speaking. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to be manageable to now go forward and say, and like in a data-driven way, what are the things that are most used? What are the highest leverage things, which are like there are frameworks like that are out there on GitHub that are popular that people are using, and like let's work with those because to try to have them move over to supported things, but also just based on just long tail of things that people are using. Not long tail. This is the opposite of long tail. Try to focus on the ones coming up, which are most widely used, where really there clearly common. Is demand. Yeah. And I will say this. I think our developers have been pretty good at trying to reach out to us in the past about some of these things, because some of the large developers I've actually reached out and go, why are you doing this? And they're like, you should file a bug with us. And then they go, then they point us to the issue tracker bug.
that we've ignored for a few years.
Yes, for a few years. Typically, it's basically so far back that we really have just lost track of it. And so we are encouraging, as part of that toast and the page it takes you to say, like, no, please do reach out. We have a team that is looking at them. Product managers are involved in, like, looking at that list. I should say Catherine Shi is our product manager who's kind of guiding these efforts.
Is there any kind of voting system on this, or?
Well, I think the voting is the data. Like, we have that list, and now we can go back and, like, look at the kind of a looser, not as strict static analysis.
I mean
to look at, like, hey, here's the apps.
I mean that if 100 people, you know, wanted to report one particular API, that might be more important than if one person reported it. But if there's just one bug report, there is no, like, voting in a sense, right?
Right.
Kind of like stars in the old bug tracker. I don't know if we have that now. I don't think we
do. I think issue tracker has the Me Too feature.
Oh, it does. I've just never seen it.
Okay. I know we have that internally, so I assume it's an external view too. I don't know.
But it's certainly the heat map of these things has got to be a really important thing, right? Not just, you know, one person filing this bug and maybe they were writing a hobby app and therefore how important is it, as opposed to, like, actually, you know, that single reflected method is being called by, you know, 78% of the misbehaving apps out there.
Right. So two things there. So one is, like, 4P, we really even do care about getting the reports from the long tail people to make sure that we're kind of meeting our goal of not breaking anyone intentionally in P. Better or worse, you know, we're trying to be inclusive of all the different things. But for planning going forward for the future, we are going to take a very numbers-based approach of saying, like, we can do our static analysis in a looser way and say, look, if we see references in native code or Java code to this class and this field are both there, that we think this is an app that is reflecting on this, we can look at, like, how many users are actually using that app and, like, do the analysis to say, like, these are the ones based on a user and based on either, like, numbers of apps using them, but also to scale it to, like, numbers of users using those apps to make sure that we're focusing on the apps that have the most user making a path forward for the APIs that have the most user impact and making sure that they're well supported. Because I think that's, in the end, we want to be gauging on, like, the users having a good experience.
Right. I also wondered whether not just which classes and methods are, you know, highest usage, but it seems like a lot of the issues are probably collected in libraries. Like, if there's a particular popular library that is doing a thing, then that's going to, you know, be in most of the apps out there, right?
Yes. And I think when I've kind of been tracking the app compatibility issues for O and P. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely what we see, where there's a couple GitHub frameworks that if you do something, and this is where I think we, even in O and P, we try to make, even though we don't really want to be encouraging this behavior, we'll try to make framework changes that are backward compatible with the sort of when it's possible.
Yep.
Where we see, like, oh, someone was calling some private method. Now the framework internally wanted to add a Boolean argument. There was they went and did replace string in the code, and now all existing cases use true, but, like, new cases use false or whatever. And so, can we just add the, like, one argument version back that just passes the default old behavior and then not break all these apps? And so that's where we try to do workarounds when possible, especially for the bigger frameworks, because we know, like, oh gosh, because not only do we have to work with that framework to potentially, because what often when there's no public alternative, they go, well, our modus operandi, whatever, is, okay, well, when P comes out or preview comes out, or, like, P gets closer shipping, we'll update our SDK to reflect on the new thing that you added instead of the old thing you added. But then you have to get all those apps to update to the new version of that SDK. And so that's where it's sort of this race. And I think this gets to one of the bigger issues here about why we're kind of focusing on this in the future, is that to try to improve things for the future is that right now, sometimes those developers don't have access to the preview releases. They don't have access. So they don't have access to even to the final release, because the OEMs aren't rolling out the changes. And there's kind of this vicious circle of, like, the app developers are, until I see it on my device that I have, I can't easily understand the issue and fix it. Or I'm not even aware of the problem necessarily, that there's something that they depended on got updated and they need to take a new update to their SDK or library that they're using so that then they can continue to work. So we're trying to, like, just pull that cycle in by we do try to do the outreach and the testing, but I think The biggest thing here is that what the negative effect it has on the ecosystem is that because people are worried about the developers not kind of proactively fixing these issues, because obviously the release hasn't shipped yet, so we'll deal with it when it comes out. But then OEMs are nervous about pushing updates to the new dessert because they're worried that users will be unhappy with a new dessert because apps will break and some percentage will break, and that this, you know, that's one of the biggest reasons for users updating. They're nervous about updates that might break app compatibility. And I can tell you that even the bigger issue is like they're afraid of launching new devices on the new desserts, because if a user buys a brand new device and goes in and takes it home or goes in the store and they come home and their favorite app doesn't work, or one of their apps that they use like once a week even doesn't work, they're going to return the phone. And that's a huge, cost to you know, carriers and OEMs and whatever. So they're kind of hesitant to push out. And there's kind of there's sometimes unhappiness in the ecosystem about the rate of dessert adoption and things like that. But part of it comes back to this app compatibility issue of like, that is what is causing carriers and OEMs to be nervous about updating and launching devices on new desserts. And so we're trying to like, you know, get back to the root causes of, you know, if we can get the apps to be on public's on the public SDK and make sure that we expand what that is to uncover the important use cases, then they'll feel supported and they'll be less likely to have app compatibility issues in the future. And then therefore kind of smooth the upgrade process for OEMs and for launching new devices as well.
So I know that one of the engineers who worked on this produced one of the, I guess, the light gray list by modifying DocLava to take all the private methods that we have in our SDK. And so we have that as sort of a base level. These are the relevant SDKs. But it's something you just said. I think that you can test apps on the emulator and have a pretty good sense of if they'll work on P. But that's not the same as what happens when you use a device, especially from some manufacturers, which add additional APIs. Are you aware of people using Reflection to target those special customizations? And if so, are those kinds of APIs that you would put in this blacklist?
So I think our goal, I mean, this is for like, you know, OEM specific extensions. I mean,
or changes to, you know, the framework, just customized in a different way. And so you use Reflection to tell the difference.
So I mean, I think we've gotten a lot of questions more from OEMs than app developers so far about this particular cases where they have OEM specific, you know, fingerprint APIs historically or things like that, where yeah. We have this mechanism available to you. You can choose what you want to block, you know, on your device for your extra non, you know, AOSP implementation kind of details.
Oh, they would just drop in their own blacklist files or gray list.
Yeah, so I think that is the goal, so that they can blacklist what they want, they can expose what they want, but like let them manage their own namespace kind of to themselves. But I know you were saying like because maybe an OEM has changed the implementation of some framework piece, and then they might have been had to change how the Reflection is working. I haven't seen any specific comments about that. I have seen some feedback that sometimes app developers are using Reflection to work around OEM specific bugs.
Right.
And that is
so we're like, hey, there's an alternative. Look at this public method. Yet they can't because there's some other reason why they can't.
Right. And they may have to like do some Reflection and poke some bits before or after some other called, and then they make another like.
Right.
So we have heard that feedback, and obviously existing cases of what we've seen of that we're adding to the list. It is actually a concern going forward about how to manage that. And I think I wasn't going to get into it today, but I mean we are looking at having the ability to dynamically update the list of what's allowed or like what needs to be to have holes in case we make any launch.
We just
mistakes.
Got an exclusive.
Yeah, I know.
This is great.
Scoop for the podcast today.
So we are looking at doing that as part of P. But particularly because of these sort of cases where it's hard to figure out, like we don't know until we find out there's going to be a problem with some implementation. And then, you know, it's sort of a legitimate need. Like the app's like, look, I need to do this, but the public API you have is not quite working right on some devices. And so we are looking to try to make it possible for us to update the list, do a delta to that dynamically.
Would it be possible then for apps to reflect on the current list on the device to figure out what they can reflect on? It's just a proposal.
So I'm going to guess no. I think the security people are trying to have a, you know, you have access to things that that you need access to. And so they're trying to prevent.
This file probably shouldn't be world writable, just an idea.
Well, it's actually, I mean, getting into the implementation details, some of it's not a file. We're actually reusing unused bits in the DEX file format for the things in the framework in the boot class path. To encode whether like we had a couple free bits, so that we could do two bits, we could do four states, and hence we have four like, you know, light white, I light, see. So dark.
You actually are letting the reflection go through. You pull up the method and you look at it and say, are you actually marked for?
Yeah, well, and we know that, and we obviously were doing that reflection or the JNI or whatever. We have the class and the method in hand, and so we were using some bits that were unused to encode this information for now.
It's clever.
And it's not, it's only in the, I think that's why you know about the tooling work they were doing, is because they were trying to hook in to that so they could get that information about how. So then they could.
Well, I know because I'm trying to kill DocLava. So I had to reimplement the same thing in the replacement for DocLava.
Sorry.
So actually, I was curious about how the mechanism worked. You explained part of it, but when a method gets called, even if it's on the blacklist, it's not necessarily bad because it may be in the call stack of, you know, the SDK calling it internally, right? So how do you figure out at runtime, and how do you avoid any performance overhead of doing all this stuff?
You know, that's a good question, Chad.
We're even now. 1-1. All right.
So, because it gets to what happens when you're on the blacklist, what actually happens, like you ask for something and what happens in your app. So what we do is, you know, we try to make sure you just can never get a handle to one of these. So for reflection, you know, if you try to call and say, I'm reflecting, I want this field or this method that's there, well, basically you'll get no such field or no such method error, and it'll throw.
Yeah.
And so it's at that point when you try to look it up is when we can block you and check it. So we don't have to check an actual. And so there's three cases. So that's the first case is when you ask in reflection. The second case is when you ask in JNI. Similarly, it's basically the same. There's get method ID or get field ID.
Yeah.
I'm dating myself and not quite remembering the names. But then the third case is like, you could, you know, some people do this. They take like the Android stubs jar kind of approach where they'll make a stub version of a class that's not part of the SDK, and they'll just kind of put it in their project and link against it. And so even then, when we see like we're doing the, what we call the class linker in Art that links, you know, you're doing class loading and you say, oh, God, this thing has a field of this type, and we go to find it, we'll go, wait, that's not a field that should be, a type that should be visible to you. And then, you know, the class loading will fail. So it's basically every time we're going to resolve a reference at a kind of metadata level to a field or a method that we kind of, that's where we do the enforcement. So
that's what's really clever about using the fields is you can do this very cheaply. Whereas if it was some sort, if you had to make every method dispatch go and look up against some database, that would be probably noticeably slower.
Yeah, well, so that was a big focus for us both on system health, not having a performance impact.
Yeah.
I think that there's maybe a little bit of impact during the lookup, but it's sort of most people, it's sort of the number of times you actually look up the field and method versus like actually doing the reflective, give me the value orders of magnitude difference.
Also, we have the advantage of reflection in JNI being slow to begin with. And so, you know, the overhead on top of that. It's gotten better.
We try to make that better. We actually focus more on making the actual like getting values fast, because that's, again, more most people spend their time is getting sending fields.
Yeah, I mean, because you'll typically do the reference lookup and cache it, but then you keep iterating on the gimme, gimme, gimme. I mean, that's what your animation stuff did, right?
Right, yeah. Look it up once. Originally through JNI, and then reflection got faster, and I think it got refactored to do the right thing.
I'll say that the code for JNI, it goes into reflection.cc. Like, they really are, the mechanisms are actually very close in the internal implementation. I think.
Oh, in Art?
In Art, and I think in Dolvik as well before.
Really? Because there was definitely, there was a substantial timing difference.
The lookup itself was different.
Or were you using bubble sort around it, perhaps?
It was not the lookup, it was the execution of it.
The execution is different, but the actual like resolving, looking for fields and methods.
So JNI is just a wrapper around the reflection capabilities.
Because I think that, you know, we have like, you know, Java, you get like a Java lang reflect method object, like the J method ID or whatever in JNI, like the mechanism to find those things. And maybe there's a little bit of a wrapper for how you expose it to C++ and C versus, you know, obviously Java object references. But underneath, the lookup mechanism is shared.
Actually, you just made me wonder whether anybody's using animators that are going to hit the blacklist because they're just trying to animate a thing.
So I have to say that's another good point you're making, because one thing we didn't think about was serialization. So serialization uses a bunch of private methods, like read object, write object. There's like read resolve. I'm being bad now. I don't remember the exact one. But we're like, wait, those are and if you're calling and doing serialization through, you know, the standard object input stream, object output stream, it's fine. And like we realize it's coming from the system, and it's an okay use of it. But there was an object relational mapping tool that's pretty popular. I'm just not trying to be biased about giving names here, but it kind of did its own. It used the reflection sort of interface, which is all private method based, to do its own serialization of things to databases to save things. And we're like, you know, that's sort of legitimate. Even it's kind of like everyone, if you go look at the specifications for this stuff, even though they're private methods, it's well-defined behavior that has well-defined names. So we actually went and made sure that the tool that does the generation is like letting you do reflection on these private fields that are related to serialization. And I think that's one that maybe accidentally went out in developer preview. There was the read and write object ones we got. There was like, there's this read resolve where you can replace an object with like an existing object, I think maybe for some special cases of graph deserialization or something. And we missed that in our tool. So we got a few reports of, hey, that's, why are you getting this error? And it's like, oh, that's serialization. We forgot to add that case. So when it comes to your question was about like as the animator stuff, that's I would maybe want to talk more to you, talk more with you about that.
I mean,
but that's like the framework is doing the reflection on their stuff.
Probably their code, but I mean, it could be a class of ours as well. But in general, it's only doing reflection because there is no way to get, you know, a method reference in earlier versions.
Yeah.
And so this was the way that you find out, well, I want to animate this X thing. Theoretically, there's a public setter that I am allowed to call.
And that's what, you know, because the reflection would be coming from the framework would be okay. Because what we do when we're doing the enforcement is we look at who on the call stack, oh, that's the frame. It's, you know, we can look at from the coming from the apps class loader or from the systems class loader.
I see. So all I have to do to use reflection is to wrap it in object animator, animate for 0 seconds. It will basically call it for me.
I'm sure that'll be on Stack Overflow shortly.
Right. And Chet invented that security hole. That's great.
So
security hole.
Back to the performance question then. If you're actually looking up the call stack to make sure whether this is a valid caller at the top, like isn't that causing overhead? Like
so only at the time of when they do look up the fielder method object. So and that's actually pretty cheap. We have to do that a lot of times in art, like to make decisions about like what to do, because we're trying to like when we're loading classes and we're loading class and it's always relative to what class loader you're currently in. So we have pretty fast paths for looking at the stack to find these things.
Okay. Cool. Anything we miss in the whole blacklist, whitelist? I was thinking we need, all the new color capabilities, we need a red list in there, meaning, you know, an app is doing the wrong thing and hemorrhaging somewhere in the middle, but we'll go with your grayscale thing. That's fine.
Well, I mean, we sort of jumped into the technology very quickly without talking about the rationale, but then you got into it in the middle and you talked about that this is really all about compatibility. You know, we have this other effort that we did recently for compatibility around target SDK version. You want to say some more stuff about that?
Yeah. So I think we announced them at the end of last year, the Play Store policies around sort of target SDK and around 64-bit. And so for target SDK, it's really just wanting to make sure that our users are getting the sort of the best experience. Like there was a number of things, like for example, in Marshmallow about like having the permissions kind of be opt-in for the users, and there was things in and I'm trying to get my letter straight. And was it background check? Is that what I can't remember? It's been so long; it's like a year ago now.
Yeah, background.
That you know is trying to improve like battery behaviors We really want to make sure like you know if apps are not updating to the latest versions, we're not getting this new, better user experience for users. And so we want to kind of encourage that through policy on Play Store of just saying like, hey, you know, within some time frame, and I think we're starting out with a year look back of saying, you know, by the time P is launching, we'd really like you to be targeting O from a behavioral point of view, because we want to have users having the sort of most modern experience, or like not, I guess not most modern, but a recently modern from within the last year of what we're trying to do to kind of scale those efforts out, you know, because otherwise if apps are just staying back forever on, you know, KitKat or whatever targeting versions
so it's not retroactively reaching into your phone and deleting apps. It's just that the new apps and app updates are going to have to target more recent versions.
Yeah. So any existing apps on your phone, or existing apps on Play Store that are maybe not getting frequent updates. We generally feel looking at the numbers that, you know, most apps that affect the most users, like they are getting updated like once a year or something. So I think this is a relatively good cadence to try to get people to, you know, it helps move things forward pretty quickly, I think, at the scale of the ecosystem. But it shouldn't, again, disrupt people who happen to have apps that aren't getting updated anymore.
I have kids that if you don't like look at them and remind them every couple of years, they will be wearing clothes that really stopped fitting a couple of years ago. So it's just kind of a reminder to just, you know, that stuff should go away and you should be using newer stuff. Yeah, user experience. All right, anything interesting in the preview that's worth talking about?
I wanted to talk about the 64-bit side of that coin as well. Because a part of that policy announcement was also that there is going to be a desire to try to get app developers to, you know, if you're uploading an app that has native code, like please start including either in the same APK, but also like with multiple APK to target 64-bit devices. And I think that's just, our ecosystem is pretty diverse. And it's not like we're not kind of dropping 32-bit because like we clearly have Android Go devices that are 32-bit. I primarily that, you know, big launches around that with Mobile World Congress in the last couple of weeks. But the higher end devices are almost all entirely 64-bit. And we do pay a cost on a 64-bit device for storage, for the 32-bit compatibility support. We have a lot of memory overhead because we have to have like, you know, two versions of the system, like, you know, ready to start apps. There's a cost to 64-bit users for this backward compatibility. And so we'd really like to be able to have 64-bit only devices alongside 32-bit only devices in the future. And so we haven't gotten any feedback negatively about this in terms of, it's just, you know, some app people are grumbling, oh, we're going to finally have to test this. But
yeah, I mean, for most people, it's like tweaking one compiler flag, right?
Right.
Probably not much work. I mean, compared to bumping up target SDK version, depending on where you are now, could be potentially a lot of work. If you have a large code base, I think updating to dangerous permissions, that's a pretty tricky change for a lot of developers.
Because they got to consider the UX impact and things like that.
Yeah.
And the background check, I think, was also
suddenly some method, you may have to sort of do this callback. And so getting back from the activity to where you are right now is tricky. So it's a bit more work, whereas this, I would hope, for most people, it's mainly the testing burden, I guess. But everyone has UI test, right? Right?
Sure.
Yeah, sure. 100%.
All right.
So to get back to Chet's question about developer preview, so there were a couple things in the broader scope of my team that we did. One was the Kotlin enhancements in Android runtime.
I think, did Jeffrey allude to that when we talked to him about some of the R8 and D8 stuff? I think
we talked, I think, only about R8 and D8, not anything about runtime.
Right. And I think he did talk a little bit about it. We're trying to work the whole stack to make sure everything is as optimized for Kotlin. So it started like all the way at the top of Kotlin C, and making, you know, getting obvious things fixed in Kotlin C. Like there was even, I think, some minor issue where version of Kotlin C at the time its studio shipped, like there was a newer version that was already better than
that's always the case. I mean, as soon as we ship something, they have a new version of Kotlin out.
Right. So I remember when we were just benchmarking on the team doing some of this work to try to figure out how we could, and we're like, we would be benchmarking and we're like, different people getting different results because one was using the Kotlin C from upstream and one was using the one from studio. So we're like, we should tell studio this.
Yes.
But you guys are always updating. But like, so yeah, it's improving Kotlin C obviously and has the most impact for across the broadest number of users, then doing further optimizations in D8 and R8 to further optimize things, kind of especially with the scope of like looking at your program and understanding the whole program and optimizing it further.
That's where you can do things like, hey, this is a property. The compiler made a getter and set it for it, but you're just accessing it. Let's go right back to the field.
Right. And then I think the thing is in R8, like we do a lot of sort of like kind of deeper, kind of more like textbook optimizations about loops and things like that. And like, you know, I'm not saying that it's pattern matching, but there's a lot of like control flow analysis and whatever. And like some of the loops, you know, we did a bunch of combination of using the Kotlin auto convert tool and took a bunch of things and auto converted them. We are actually doing a bunch of hired someone to do a bunch of idiomatic Kotlin benchmarks that we're working on now as well. But like to compare the performance of the Java version with the Kotlin version and see like where are the gaps. And so we went through a bunch of them. Most of our loop optimizations did do the right thing, but there were a couple of cases where, you know, there was some code produced by that we kind of were unexpected. Well, I guess that is a loop that we could optimize that we kind of missed.
Actually, out of curiosity, and this is not just for Kotlin, this would be Java as well, but the using the streams APIs, you know, map and all that stuff, do you do anything special for those or how do they perform for the non-multi-core case? I mean, I understand they're great when you can sort of do this, you know, take advantage of an executor where you're actually doing large computation. But if you have sort of a simple loop, the IDE will say, oh, here's this nice for loop. You should turn this into a, you know, as a sequence followed by this, followed by that. And in some cases, I've seen that the Kotlin compiler turns it into equivalent for loops, right? But it doesn't always do that. So I'm wondering if you, at the art level, are doing anything sort of for these patterns.
So we try to do that like through inlining. But sometimes, like, depending on how complicated and how nested things get, like the level of inlining we would need to do to be aware that, like, oh, we can completely, like, I don't want to put too, I guess I just want to put, don't want to put too much faith in compilers, having been burned in the past by them myself, to do. So if it is something really performance sensitive, like, I don't want to encourage people to depend on the optimizer. Ramon is always telling people, and I guess Jake Wharton too, is like, you know, decompile and look at the bytecode and, like, be very happy to see that it was clever and it took that code that was, you know, idiomatic Kotlin and turned it into a for loop for you. But the problem is a little bit more opaque with art, and, like, sometimes the variables of, like, oh, you might have tested it, now you've changed things slightly, and now suddenly the optimizer has missed that.
Right.
What you thought was a small tweak was suddenly, like, pushed it beyond the bounds of what it, the scope of what it could see. So I think we do try to do some work like that, but I don't want to oversell it too much.
Yeah.
Are there common things that you've seen in either the auto-convert stuff or the idiomatic stuff that you're starting to look into where common things in Kotlin are causing, you know, more performance overhead or larger opportunities for optimization than you're used to?
No, I mean, I think it's been pretty good. Like I said, we took a bunch of our benchmarks that we have and like, you know, auto converting them. Like, no, almost all of them were like on par performance wise. Like I said, we had a couple of them that were kind of more micro benchmarks and not like larger kind of meaningful app kind of benchmarks that. That we got caught out and we did improve art to cover those cases better. But I would not say that that is the typical case.
Okay.
Well, I'm glad to hear you're also looking at idiomatic Kotlin because the converter is great, but not perfect, right? There's many cases. I mean, typically when I take existing Java code and convert it, I have to do a bunch of post-processing to clean things up. It does some weird things sometimes.
Yep. So we're definitely looking at both. But auto-converting obviously was the first because it was a little hanging fruit.
It's actually also handy as our entire developer base is in the process of, you know, spinning up on Kotlin and probably starting there.
Yeah. Yeah. And every now and then, especially in the beginning when I couldn't remember how to do something, like how do you do a byte array, you know, in Kotlin? It's nice to just do it in Java and then convert like, oh, that's right. There's a dedicated class. Fine. Right.
Let's see. And then there was something else you'd mentioned earlier when we were walking over here about deck size stuff.
Right. So I think the other thing we mentioned in the developer preview was, I'm trying to remember the words. I'll use the internal word, which is, we call it compact decks, which is by Matthew Chartier. And what he's doing on device is he's rewriting the app's dex code. And we had talked about this in the past, in past years where we were rewriting things to have better locality. Mm-hmm. We were kind of, and so just maybe, and some of that we had to break some of the rules about dex and how it's formatted and structured. But largely still, it was still DEX on the disk. Like a DEX tool would be able to still disassemble it and dump it and whatever. But we're going beyond now and saying, like, look, we know there are overheads. Like, you know, multi-DEX is great from a backward compatibility support library point of view. But, like, if you actually merge them into one file, you can, there's, like, some redundancies where you have string references in both files and, you know, or method references or field references for common fields. It's like, well, no, if we actually were one larger unified DEX file, we could remove some of the overhead. But then once you do that, there's also, like, well, there might be strings that are only referenced as metadata, not actually referenced by the bytecode, so we could kind of maybe further optimize things. And so that's what we're trying to do on device now for you is that when you install that the, not the version obviously in your APK, but the version that's like what you use at runtime is smaller. And I think we're seeing on average about 11% savings. And so for larger apps, that's, I mean, any app, I mean, some apps have like tens of megabytes of DEX code that this is, you know, pretty significant savings for users that sort of, you know, automatic. And I think that's just the start. We're looking to do more going forward. And I think at some point we might want to like say like, hey, if this is something that's better as a general format and we have better ways of doing like target SDK targeting kind of more automatically that we could make it so that, you know, this would be another public format that like app developers would have access to directly to help impact the APK size kind of side of things as well. But for now, it's sort of happening on device.
That was the percentage you claimed that was specifically DEX size, not like overlay.
Yes, it is the DEX bytecode size as it's and the installed size. And I think the biggest thing there is it's like that saves storage, but it also saves memory for users as well. And the combination of like it should, you know, we see some impact on a positive impact on app startup time because you're just there's less to load,
but also more locality because you have less intervening stuff, right?
And it's good because often you pay, you know, those are trade-offs. You know, you can make things smaller, but now it's compressed, slower to read. You have to, you know, deflate on load time. But it sounds like what you've done is you don't have that. You don't have that as a negative with the solution. It's just basically less data that's faster to load. And
yep,
that's awesome. More of that.
Yeah, yeah, sounds good. And I expect we'll be talking to you or your team about more specifics as sort of P rolls out.
But yep,
I think that does it for today. Anything else?
I just want to thank David Brasdell, who's been doing a lot of this app compatibility work. I didn't try to find a way to work him in, but yeah, he's been driving all this stuff from our London team. So
should we delete this and go talk to David instead?
Well, when's the next time you're going to be in London is the problem.
Okay. All right.
I think you should talk to him next time you're in London.
Okay. All right. I'll arrange that. Great. Thanks.
Thank you.